Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to yet another exciting episode of the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live on AmericanFreedomRadio.com 4 days a week, Monday to Thursday in the United States, and Tuesday through Friday. For those of you here in New Zealand, you'll have to excuse my breathlessness, because I just got off a two-hour pre-record with Cliff High, which will be played on the network not too long from now, as soon as I got it edited and uploaded. But today, however, we have two guests for the first hour joining me from Sovereign Mind Radio is Sonia Barrett. No relation to Kevin Barrett, I take it?
No, not at all. And Sovereign Mind Radio, I apologize, it is no more. That was a long time ago. Anyway, but I just thought I would make sure that I say that it's no more. I used to have a radio show called Sovereign Mind Radio.
Okay, so the former host of Sovereign Mind Radio, which is... it's now Strip Mind Radio.
It's actually Interbridge Radio, but because the film, which we'll talk about, I had to postpone doing the show for a while because the film took so much time. So I don't do the show anymore, at least not for now.
Yeah, well, sometimes you do have to take a day off from your day job in order to get the real work done. I think, though, what we'll do then instead is let you explain a little bit about who you are and what it is you do for those who are unclued in on the audience.
Well, that's a good question. Sometimes when people say, well, what do you do? I always say, what do you mean right now? so many things. But anyway, I am Sonia Barrett, and I am the author of The Holographic Canvas, The Fusing of Mind and Matter, and another book called The Journey of Possibilities, and a more recent book called Health and Inside Job and Outside Business, which is a supplement to a documentary that I produced called The Business of Disease. Outside of that, before doing the film, much of what I'm known for is speaking about, I think, the programming of human beings, of humanity in general on many levels, and how much of our lives are our own authentic, what should I say, concepts, ideas, so on and so forth. And some of my work is, it definitely hinges on quantum physics, taking a look at reality, you know, all of those components. That would sort of sum up where I'm coming from a level of how free are we, you know, and what is freedom.
And so that's your passion, is it?
Yes, because it's really about my journey. That's really why I do all of what I do. It's really my own search, my own quest, my own curiosity. And I just happen to then share it with other people and do lectures and workshops and all of those things. But yes, my passion is understanding more about what we call reality and my place in it.
What was your motivation for this? Did something bad happen to you, or did somebody good give you a clue up and inspire you? Or a little bit of both?
Well, you know, I guess I've always been curious. You know, as far back as I can remember as a child, I've always had a curiosity about life in general, people dying. You know, I always thought that was a little weird. People died and nobody, I just felt like nobody really questioned it. What goes on here? People just disappear. So my curiosity has always been there. But I would say as I moved on in my life, in my adult life, I went through a divorce, and after about 14-year marriage, it made me wonder, you know, what this was all about. It made me take a deeper look at everything because of the struggles that I experienced, and, you know, people in general around me would experience, whether it be from, you know, financial to relationships to you name it. And so my curiosity was heightened by my experience or by my getting out of that relationship and just wanting to understand more about the world I live in. And once I started to investigate within my own self and obviously and externally, it all sort of started to unravel. And you start seeing how all these pieces, you know, fit together, you know, politically and, you know, religiously or spiritually, that it was all this really big quilt that somehow it was weaved together.
And who do you reckon is the tapestry maker here?
Well, you know, that's a question that, when people ask, well, who's making it? And I think it's very hard to give a one answer to that, because I know a lot of times we do want an answer that says that there is one particular being or force or entity that's involved or doing anything to us. But I think it's got many layers to it, and it brings into question, you know, who we are beyond these bodies. And it just brings into question the whole nature of everything. So there are levels where we are responsible, and then there are levels outside of that, what I like to call the whole thing the game. There are levels outside of the game as we know it to be, with, you know, master players on many levels. So it's a very big question. So it's no point. It's hard to point your finger at any one. Person, you're talking about government, that's a whole other story. If you're talking about just life here on Earth, you know, that's a whole different assessment as well. It's like the Russian dolls, you know, there's one and the other and the other. It's a matrix and a matrix and a matrix.
Well, if it wasn't ridiculously complex, somebody would have easily figured it out, you know. So
absolutely,
that's how it's remained concealed. And I find that's how liars work, really. They just tell you such complex nonsense or whatever, and then you just, instead of going, you know, overall, that's just nonsense, this guy's a scumbag, you just go, okay, I guess I'll believe it. It sounds nice.
Well, yeah, I think that's what happens, though. I think people are sort of programmed to believe that if it's really complicated, it must be true or something like that. You know, if somebody seemed to you know, say something that it's extremely or seems highly intellectual, we sort of take that at, you know, face value, that's got to be what it is. But it's simple, but it is complex at the same time about all of this. And I think it just boils down to the fact that, you know, we have a society that is programmed with, you know, set of beliefs. Across the board, you know, what we actually will believe, whether it be from religion or our whole spiritual belief to our political beliefs to just, you know, you name it. So I think we're living by other people's rules and designs.
Well, I think part of the conversation I was having before the show is about control. Now, psychopaths, for example, absolute unbelievable controllers. They love it. They can't get enough of it. But the problem with being a controller is that you have to suppress things in order to stop things getting out of control and retain inside yours. And so they've created all these institutions in order to suppress every part of being human. So they created the school and academia to suppress the mind. They created They also created religions to suppress the soul and our ability to connect with higher consciousness, and so on and so forth. Whatever mainstream institution you can really think of, that's it.
Right. Well, that's absolutely true. I mean, and those are the core systems in place in our reality, which is, as you just said, you know, there's religion, and then there is our academic system, our school system, which basically sort of prepares you to go out there into the bigger program, the bigger matrix, and learn how to operate and, you know, be controlled, basically. So, yeah, we are definitely dealing with some interesting levels then of control from the minute we get here, basically. Because you figure, you know, your parents, most parents, don't know and don't understand. So what they do is they pass on the same beliefs and same programs, and just sort of usher us into the same sort of controlled, you know, system, not knowing any better. So it goes on.
They kind of school you into accepting insanity, and that's why I call them academia nuts.
That's true. I love that, academia nuts. That's true. It's exactly what it is. They school you into it, and then you end up living by the rules of you know, whatever the success rules are, the success and failure rules are, and the good person rule, I like to call it, or, you know, bad person. So there are these barometers, you know, measuring sticks, how we measure ourselves. But it's all sort of structured. It's all sort of in place for us to have something to measure ourselves up against and make sure, you know, that we're living within the constructs of this, you know, measuring device. And you get people like yourself or myself or those people who are listening to your show who sort of push the envelope and they're scratching their heads, usually from childhood. Usually I find that a lot of the people who are like this have been like that for a long time, where everybody else go, you know, right and we go left. So you're questioning, you're always questioning, which is not something that's really encouraged in a, you know, controlled, such a tightly controlled system. So yeah, there is a lot for people to wake up to, because it's the control and the programming is layers deep.
It's also that kind of complexity, as I mentioned before, that's allowed it to remain concealed. And I think I was talking with Mark Passio last week or the week before, talking about apocalypse. And apocalypse means the revealing of truth or the lifting of the veil. And what we're essentially doing as a movement, and I don't even know if it's, you know, we're actually all together in this movement or whatever. I'm more thinking it's 100 different spines of a cactus all just being as big a pricks as they can to the New World Order scumbaggery foot that's coming down on us, you know, the old jackboot. And that's the problem with people who are psychopathic control freaks, is that they don't have creativity. And that's the great thing about just being a regular human being. We do. So we can do things that are unpredictable.
Right, absolutely. And it really is about doing that. And to do things that are, I guess, on that level of being unpredictable, I think that's when you're starting to walk into a level of freedom outside of the constructs that have been sort of designed and defined, you know, for human beings. So I think, again, you know, just looking at the idea of freedom, that's been defined for, it's been defined for us in terms of what we measure, how we measure freedom, what we think freedom is. So again, it's all of these components that people really have to look at. And, you know, you'll talk to some that will say, oh no, I get it, you know, I'm free. But the game is so intricately designed that most people just don't realize that just because you're not, you know, behind bars, that you are living under some really deep levels of restrictions from, you know, from your spiritual belief, as you just mentioned before, your consciousness. You know, all of that is under an umbrella of a level of restriction, and you are sort of taught to not step outside those boundaries in terms of what you should believe, you know, or should not believe.
Well, and of course, the consequence of, like, just not swallowing it is you have to swallow another bitter pill, the realization that everybody else has swallowed it, and they think that you're crazy for regurgitating.
Right.
I mean, this is the, it's the information. Yeah, well, I mean, it's like the information equivalent of sticking your fingers down your throat. It's kind of like an intellectual bulimia, you know? Somebody will give me this burger, and it's like full of BS, and I'll be like, take a bite in it, and like,
Oh my God, it tastes terrible. It's not good. It's not settling down with me. It doesn't have any nutrition. I hate this burger. I hate it.
You know, and it's not like I'm going to send it back and get them to recook it or anything, because I know the only thing they're going to do is just cook it up a little bit more and make it slightly worse. It's not going to make it better.
Yeah, absolutely. It's, you know, it is, as you say, it's people just swallowing or taking in information without questioning, you know, without asking any questions about exactly what it is that's being said to them, whether it be in the media, across the board. And so when people come along, like maybe yourself or myself, or again, those people that are like that, and you try to perhaps present certain kinds of information, it's not readily accepted.
Right. Well, we're coming to break now, ladies and gentlemen. You are listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. Bear in mind, this is a listener-supported broadcast, so it does not work without your donations. And those people who sign up to give a regular monthly gift are so much appreciated, because, honestly, fighting for truth is not something that will make you rich, only something that will help you survive. We'll be right back. You are listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live on AmericanFreedomRadio.com, and thank you very much for listening in live, those of you who do. Other than that, there are archives, I believe, on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. I'll have to double-check that. If not, they'll be on the homepage of the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. There's a little slider there. Now, last week, one of my sponsors who'd been sponsoring me for a long, long time, has given me $100 a month, and I'm very, very grateful. It's made everything basically not on a knife's edge in terms of life. They just cancelled their subscription all of a sudden for absolutely no reason, kind of like crazy sort of stuff, you know? False accusations, no you know? How people are like that? It's weird. But anyway, if other people who aren't crazy have some spare cash, and in this economy I know that's pretty unlikely, please go to the VinnieEastwoodShow.com and start up a regular monthly gifting today. We'd very much appreciate that to take us back to square one. In addition to that, this morning, a Jordan Maxwell video, you'll have to excuse me for that, called Jehovah's Witnesses Exposed, that I conducted earlier on in the year with Santos Bonacci, was removed from YouTube due to a false copyright complaint. And that video on itself was getting a lot of hits, and it had the AdSense on it, and it was producing about 20% of the revenue of my entire YouTube channel. So there's that too. And this dude who's done it, I forget his name, Joe Dislick or something, but he has stolen all of Jordan Maxwell's career worth of work. All of it. And now whenever Jordan produces anything new, they do copyright complaints and sue people in order to stop his information getting out without their ownership over it. That is parasitical scum of the highest order. Anybody who's on Facebook, please go to search Vinnie Eastwood on Facebook and add me. And one of the posts that was made today is a email template and an explanation and a few screenshots of the case there. So you can help out by emailing this piece of trash and tell him to give Jordan Maxwell back all his stuff. And do it frickin' immediately. I'm sorry, I'm getting really upset about it. It's not about the money for me. I just know what it's like to have your life's work destroyed, because it happened to my YouTube channel during the 2014 New Zealand election. Got taken out for 2 months because I made a video exposing the Prime Minister in 6 minutes, and then in 7 days, every single video I'd ever made, 3,000 of them odd, was deleted. But it came back 2 months later, on November the 5th, no less. I found that interesting. Anyway, my very special guest today is Sonia Barrett. Welcome back.
Yes, I'm just listening to you. I can just sit back and listen to you. I'm having fun doing that.
All right, well, keep continuing to sit there. I've got some ranting to do. I'm just joking. I don't know. It's like sticking up for other people in the movement is a... it's sort of like a part-time job, you know? Promoting them as the full-time and catching them when they fall, especially when they can't defend themselves, because, like, I don't know, people like us, we're not aggressive. We don't destroy people who try to mess with us. We just lose, move on, and start creating new stuff that's all our own. And some part of me feels an inherent injustice at that fact, because one day we'll be backed against the wall, all of us.
Yeah, I don't think you can always turn the other cheek. I don't think so. I think there are times, depending on the severity of the situation, that you do have to say something. You do have to, you have to stand up for yourself. So I don't think that is necessarily the way to roll either. If it's something minor, fine. But I understand, because I've been down that road. I think we all kind of have, where somebody is either using your information, they're not really giving you any credit for it. I mean, there's a lot of people that I know have definitely gone down that road. I am familiar with Jordan's situation, though. So, yeah, this has been going on for a while.
Yeah. I mean, just what I don't get is that I had Jordan and Santos Bonacci on my show on American Freedom Radio. I edited the video. I put up the archive on the VinnieEastwoodShow.com, and yet for some reason, it's their copyrighted fucking effing material. Sorry about that, ladies and gentlemen. I'm really pissed off.
Yeah, well, I guess it depends on somehow it sounds like that person must have taken over the Jordan Maxwell name, almost like owned the copyright to him, or basically is what, you know, there's some weird thing involved there where this person has ownership of something, the name, his name, something. So sort of like, I think anybody can take out life insurance on you. I know it's not the same thing, but in a way it's kind of weird to think that anybody can take out insurance on you I don't even think you need to know about it. So there's a lot of interesting things that can happen out there in our matrix world.
And if you're not a psychopath, you just don't see it coming, because you never think like that.
Thinking like that, exactly. Yeah, yeah. You're not thinking like that, and I understand being blindsided, because you just can't wrap your mind around somebody doing whatever it is they're doing. It's like, why would you even do that? And so it throws us, because we're on our merry way doing our merry or whatever thing, and then you get knocked in the head by a rock. You're just like, what happened? Yeah.
Where did that come from? But anyway, for those of you who want to actually email the claimant, Joseph Dolezal, Dolezal, his email is helpjordanmaxwell@gmail.com. And tell him what you think of him, and ask him to retract his copyright claim. I've got an email template on my Facebook. It says, Vinnie Eastwood created a YouTube video with Jordan Maxwell and Santos Bonacci called Jehovah's Witnesses Exposed. It has been pulled from YouTube recently due to a copyright claim from you. I respectfully request you withdraw this claim immediately, as you did not have any part in the creation of that content. Vinnie Eastwood conducted the interview and made the video himself, and therefore you have no grounds to make a copyright claim. A counterclaim has already been lodged with YouTube, and your entire YouTube channel can be suspended permanently, in addition to being banned from creating another YouTube account in the future for making a false claim. You have 48 hours notice to withdraw it, otherwise within the next 10 days YouTube will review the claim, restore the video, and then ban you.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying, and I, as you were reading that, I started thinking also about the record company. And, for example, I remember when Prince changed his name to get out of his record contract, so he wouldn't – the contract was still there, but he was using – what was the artist formerly known as Prince, in order to be able to create more material. So it sounds to me, again, like a situation where somehow that person, like a record company, owns that. Because if they do, then you can't, or you're in some kind of contract with them, then you can't really go out, according to the contract, and record or do anything else with someone else, because somehow, according to your contract, whatever you do belongs to them. I don't know. It just sounds to me like there's some weird thing, loopy thing there. Some weird thing. Why this person has been able to do this for such a long time?
Yeah,
because it's been several years.
People would be questioning the legality of this, and I don't. Does it sound psychopathic? Yeah. Does it sound even crazy? Yeah. Is somebody being shafted and another person getting all the benefit? Yeah. Well, then it's probably legal.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. I mean, you know, it does sound a little crazy, but obviously, you know, there could be it might be done legally. Somebody can be crazy, but at the same time, there's crazy brilliant. You know, I've known a couple of people like that are, they're crazy, but at the same time, they're smart in being crazy. So
I had to work on it, you know.
So yeah, it's just, you know, it's just all kinds of people, and that's the only thing I can say on that situation. But
okay,
yeah.
Well, let's switch topics then back to you, the actual guest, because we're running away 10 minutes of this segment and we haven't even talked about you yet.
That's okay. I'm open to talk about whatever, so I'm fine. That's because I know Jordan. I mean, you know, I met him back in the 90s, early 90s.
I wanted to ask you something like completely left field. What makes you happy? Because I was talking to so many researchers lately, and because their researching is their work and their joy, they sometimes forget that in their spare time there's something that they can do to, I don't know, reconnect with nature or to get some exercise or something like that outside of their career path in order to keep themselves balanced so they can continue to work.
Well, I'm a hiker, so I mean, I hike. You know, I used to hike maybe 6 days a week, but I hike maybe a little bit less because my schedule. But I hike maybe 3-4 times a week, like every morning, between 6 o'clock, 6:30. I leave and I go hike because I'm in California and there's lots of mountain, you know, trails here. And so, to me, that's what relaxes me. Nature relaxes me. So that's what I do. I go hike.
Mm. And you don't write poems up there while you're doing it, like a haiku?
No, when I go hiking, I just go hiking. I leave my phone. I never take my cell phone with me. I just go. And I love just going, you know, climbing the trails. And sometimes I get done and I might sit and just enjoy whatever that feeling. When I lived by the beach, I used to do that as well. I used to go walk to the beach pretty much every day when I lived in Orange County and lived by Laguna Beach. I'd just go and sit, you know, and watch the sunset. I'd walk in the sand. I'd run in the sand. And then I would sit and watch the sunset. And then on the weekends, I would get up early. I'd go like at 5:30, depending on what time of year it is and, you know, because how dark it is in the morning. And then I'd go, same thing, early on the beach. Of course, the tide is higher at that point, but it's just such a beautiful feeling. So for me, nature, going up to the mountains, it's just what I do to balance myself.
I think that this is probably one of the most important things because, man, sometimes it does get a bit much. And I think one of the big things that's bugging me in particular is crazy people. Like, really? Anybody who says that all conspiracy theorists are crazy is completely out of their mind. But anybody who says that no conspiracy theorist is crazy is completely out of their frickin' mind. you know, it's just... I don't know what it is about this system that just drives people into these intellectual wedges that they cannot back out of. It's almost, yeah, it's almost like they've got themselves stuck in a doorway.
So when you say that, I'm trying to clarify. What do you mean in particular in terms of...
A crazed Christian fundamentalist, neo-Nazis, mm-hmm. that kind of thing, you know?
Oh, there's a lot of that going around.
I want to know if it's getting worse, you know?
I was just watching a show called Dig, which I'd never watched before, but really pretty damn interesting because... you're looking on and you can't wrap your mind around how somebody's religious belief can give them permission to take out, you know, kill people, and they pray right before they do it. And I just can't wrap my mind around that, but they're very convinced of it. So whatever people's religious beliefs are, Jehovah's Witness or Seventh-day Adventist or, you know, whatever – people are so convinced of whatever it is that they believe in that they will do whatever they, you know, whatever it is that they, their religion requires to uphold that religion.
Dear almighty, loving, forgiving, and caring God, please help me kill as many people as possible today.
Kind of seems like that's what it is.
That's exactly what it is.
Kind of seems like it, you know? It's like, I don't know. This guy in the show was getting ready. He stripped himself and had a fire going, and then got clay. I mean, not clay, but the ashes from the fire, rubbed it all over himself as part of the cleansing process before he killed someone. It's like,
wait. Yeah, it's like maybe you've jumped the chasm here, bro. We're coming to a break now here, so we will be right back, ladies and gentlemen, at the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. Please don't blow up any public places during the break. We'll be right back. Sorry about that, ladies and gentlemen. I was just taking a wiki leak. Welcome back. It's the final segment of the first hour, and my very special guest is Sonia Barrett. Now, we were talking over the break about how long witnessing this insanity takes to drive you insane, or more to the point, witnessing the insanity for so long that you suddenly start to realize, oh my God, it's totally freaking nuts.
Yeah.
Takes a few years, doesn't it?
Yeah, it takes a little while, and again, the experiences that you end up having, you know, everything from, you know, love to survival, you know, jobs, making money, not making money. I mean, it just becomes an accumulation, and you start to see how everything works, like taking a watch apart or a clock apart, and seeing how it all works. You don't really get an opportunity to begin to see more of how the system works until you are having to be more integrated in it, and that's what takes a few years, you know, to come in contact with all of it.
And that's like phase one, realizing that there's something wrong, and then phase two is figuring out what that thing is, and then phase three is deprogramming that thing's effects on you. And that's a process that may never end. I mean, what was it? You know, the stages of depression, grief, you know, that kind of thing, the final stage being acceptance. I was reading this on a psychology website, and it says that acceptance is a stage of grief that not everybody gets to.
Right.
They stay depressed and all of that kind of thing, you know.
Right. Well, people succumb because they feel helpless. They feel like there's no way out. And sometimes people just, they go ahead and say, okay, it's sort of your succumb to your, you know, your kidnappers. You're the hostage. And you just kind of go, okay, I'm going to be here forever. So I think people feel hopeless when it comes to this bigger system that runs things. They don't know what to do. They don't know how to get around it. And the way the system is set up is that you're reminded of the punishment. You're reminded of what could happen to you if you don't comply or if you don't do it quite this way. here in the States, of course, with, you know, tickets, traffic tickets, and people getting caught up in that whole system of traffic tickets and how that can have an impact on somebody's life. I remember one day I was going by a supermarket, and I got out the car, and I'd seen this guy there before, and he was there with his dog, and he was asking, he had a sign up, you know, "We'll work for food," or whatever the sign said. And so I said to him, I said, "You know, I can buy you something." And he didn't want to do that. He wanted to work for whatever it was going to be. He didn't want to just be handed something. So I asked him, I said, "You know, what got you here?" And then he said to me, he says, "Well, he lost his license because he didn't pay because of child support. And then he lost his license. Then he ended up losing his job. Of course, and he had no car now." I mean, it just spiraled into this thing. And I've seen it. I've known people personally who have gone down that road. So my point is that when you're younger, you don't necessarily maybe see this. And as you get older and you start to get into the system of how things work, these are the things that happen. And you see somebody sleeping on the street and you have no idea how they got there. I just happened to ask this guy, you know. And here it was. It all started with not being able to pay his child support. Now he really couldn't pay it because then he had no job, and then now he doesn't have any license. He can't get his license back until he pays back child support. Can't pay back child support because he has no job.
Yeah, in fact, that's society in a nutshell. It's just passing the buck and going round and round and round and round again, isn't it? And it's just keep getting worse. You can't have this because you need that, and you can't get that until you've got this, but you can't get this because you need that.
The game loops you in. It can really loop someone in. And that's why, you know, with your question as to some people falling into a depression, because it's really hard when you fall to get up. It's not always easy when you fall to be able to get up because of how things are structured and what you need in order to get up. You have to really want to get up and really push and really have a real strong sense of I'm gonna make this happen. I understand, because I've been down some of those roads where I had to pull myself up from the ground. So I get it. I completely understand how challenging it is.
And I find it's like some people, it's like, it's not just a matter of, you know, willpower. In some cases, it's a matter of circumstance. Like, if you have no family, for example, if you fall, you've got nobody to stay with unless you've got friends with a spare couch or anything, you know? And
oh, yeah, you're screwed. I mean, you know, you really kind of are. I mean, there's all kinds of opportunities, as they say, you know, shelters, but a lot of those things, there's so many things attached to even that, you know, somebody going to stay in a shelter, the conditions, how long you can stay there, is the shelter full, there's so many factors, you know. And I'd been down that road, and I mean, I'm not going to get into it, but you know, years ago when I ran away with my husband with two kids, I slept in my car. Luckily I had a car. Because I had no money with me, you know, I got locked out of all the money. So I slept in my car for several days and with two kids. So I understand how hard it could be for somebody to, how are you going to pull yourself up from this? How do you redeem yourself from this situation? It was a really, really a tough one. But I am one of those people that's very resilient and extremely determined. And luckily, yes, at the time, I actually ended up got help from a church after calling around, getting help from a church. But, So years of experience gives you sometimes those opportunities to see why. So when there are people that have never gone down that road and they're making judgment about you know, how did somebody get in that situation? Man, there's so many things that go on in people's lives that can make it feel like everything is stacked against them to be able to, you know, pull it together. And there's, you know, some people start drinking just to numb the pain, or, you know, just a lot that goes on with that. But you have to really want to. And if you want to, I do see that there is always a way. There's that deeper part of you that can pull you out of those situations. That deeper part of you. I'm not talking religion. I'm talking
your spirit.
Greater part. That's right. That greater part of you that sees all, that you know, that you listen to, and sometimes it intuition, something is telling you not to go there, or you know, or to go here, or whatever the case may be. So I do see that we can. We just have to tune into that and not maybe be so external, because that's sort of what created the issues in the first place.
Well, I found out why the United States has a 25% homeless population. Veterans, right? And
right.
It was Douglas Dietrich that clued me into this. Because the military values veterans, people with field experience, they're far more lethal than the fresh grunts that they send in. And so what they do is they go into their files and they put black marks on them under these little codes, like barcodes, right? And employers check those codes, and they actually mean something. So it could mean this person was a rapist, this person's a pedophile, this person's a thief, this person's too violent, this person's got schizophrenic or anything. And these veterans come home after killing people in other countries and not wanting to ever go back, finding out that they can drive $1 million pieces of equipment, like a tank, or fly a helicopter, and they can't even get a job pumping gas. And... Yeah. Instead of re-enlisting, which is the intention of doing this to them, they would prefer to live on the streets instead of killing innocent people in another country. And that so angers me.
Yeah. Yeah, it's, you know, again, the system is just, it is what it is, and it's been run like this for a very long time, you know, very, very long time. So you're coming up against a structure that's run by experts at controlling. They've been doing it for a while, at controlling and hypnotizing and using fear.
Using fear, using all the negativity that they could possibly muster up. And we're talking about scumbags that are so negative that they've mustered up more negativity than anybody throughout the entirety of history, and have actually built a system based on negativity, based on scumbaggery. And we get born into it, and we don't even know that it's there until it comes for you. And sometimes when it comes for you, you fight back and you make something really extraordinary. Thanks for joining me, and thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for listening. We'll be right back in the second hour with James Corbett from the Corbett Report. And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show. Just because we're being exterminated doesn't mean we can't make it fun. Otherwise, what's the point of being killed? And my very special guest joining me now is James Corbett of the Corbett Report, not to be confused with Eddie Murphy's Norbert Report. James, welcome to the program.
Or the Colbert Report, which, thankfully, I outlasted him. I showed him who's boss.
Yeah. He probably had to do a cold beer report after that one to drink away his sorrows. Nah. Scumbag. Anyway, I'd like to just hear from you a little bit about who you are and what you do for those who are uninitiated. And I also want to make the point, ladies and gentlemen, you really want to search for a James Corbett video about 9/11. It's just a fantastic job you've done there, bro.
Well, thank you very much for that. Yeah, for people who don't know, I'm James Corbett. I'm at CorbettReport.com. I've been living, working in Japan for 11 years now. This is my 11th year, and I've been doing the Corbett Report since 2007. It originally started out, it was just going to be a weekly podcast, but it quickly became interviews and articles and videos, and it's just expanded and expanded since then, and now I'm writing for the International Forecaster. I have another website, FukushimaUpdate.com, talking about the latest at the Fukushima Daiichi plant. I do all sorts of video reports for Boiling Frogs Post and Global Research TV and other places. So I'm a little bit of everywhere. I hope you've found me online somewhere before, even if you didn't know it was me.
I wanted to actually hear a little bit about Fukushima because I've heard a lot of things. Now, first story that I hear is it's real bad, everything's screwed, it's virtual extinction level event, ranging for all the way to, oh, there's absolutely no radiation and that's completely fine. What do you think?
Yeah, oddly enough, I fall somewhere in between that. No, I don't believe this is extinction-level event. No, I do not believe everything is peachy keen. And basically, what should people believe? Well, how about looking at some of the evidence for what actually exists? So, it has been confirmed that the radioactive plume has reached the West Coast. And so, this has been confirmed by testing by an independent organization called Our Radioactive Ocean that's being organized. It's being basically crowdfunded to do testing off of the West Coast of the United States because there is no agency of the U.S. or Canadian government that is currently actively involved in testing the Western Pacific. So this has absolutely confirmed the radioactive plume has reached the West Coast of North America as expected. But the levels of radiation that have been detected are, well, I mean, extremely low, and people can look into that for themselves and come to their own conclusions, but I've got a bunch of information up on that, about that on FukushimaUpdate.com. I think a great video that really puts it into perspective is called Fukushima West Coast Impact. It's by Goddard's Journal, and it has links to a couple of dozen different studies that have been done and basically talking about dosages and how much has been detected and how much is likely to do damage. Puts it into perspective, historically speaking, back when they were doing open atmospheric testing out in the Pacific, what were the levels back like then? And how does that compare to what we find now with Fukushima? Basically, the people, I think, who were making the extinction level die-off, everything's going to hell in a handbasket type of claims, have greatly exaggerated a lot of this and have used a lot of faulty information in the past and never retracted their claims. So I think there's a lot of fear-mongering that goes on. And why not? It's ka-ching, ka-ching, because obviously people who are seeking out alternative media love to hear some of the fear porn and doom and gloom and will tend to believe that without much presentation of evidence. So I get why that happens. On the other side of things, of course, TEPCO and the Japanese government wants to downplay the situation as much as possible and makes everything sound like it's wonderful and tickety-boo because, you know, they've got the 2020 Olympics coming up and all of this where they're going to try to convince the world that everything's under control, whereas we do have radioactive water leaking out from the site on a daily basis into the ocean. That is known, that's confirmed, there's nothing conspiratorial about that. And the underlying problem of the entire situation, the melted down cores, is still a problem. And it will be for the foreseeable future because the technology to even approach the cores, to even look at them, see where they are lying, does not yet exist. It literally doesn't yet exist. So there's no possibility that they're actually going to be taking care of those cores, actually getting them out of there, actually containing them anytime in the near future either.
Does the technology even exist to do it?
No, it does not. It absolutely does not. And we get this from a lot of different places, but there was a post that I always go back to on Washington's blog back in 2012 that I posted up on Fukushima Update as well. Top nuclear experts, technology doesn't yet exist to clean up Fukushima. And it cites a number of different reports from a number of different people. For example, Hiroshi Tasaka of Tama University, who was talking about the government's trying to remove rods and from the spent fuel pool, but the need to develop new technology to mitigate the risk of aftershocks was still needed at that time. We had some of the main contractors who have been hired to help clean up the site, including Energy Solutions, said the top boss of that company said there is no technology which can be directly applied to extract fuel debris from Fukushima. You had the William Magwood of the telling the U.S. Senate Committee on Environment and Public Works there will need to be new technologies and new methodologies created to be able to enable them to clean the site up. And some of those technologies don't exist yet, so there's a long way to go with that. Again, the quotes just keep coming and coming. So, yes, no, the technology doesn't exist. They're trying all sorts of crazy things. People might have heard about the ice wall idea, where they were literally going to try to freeze the ground to stop groundwater from running through the site and spilling out into the ocean. That was a failure. They're now going to try a shape-changing robot to try to get anywhere near the reactor core, I believe in Unit 1, to try to see where it's lying. But again, they're just trying these types of experimental technologies out, and radiation levels near the cores are just too high, and every robot and camera and whatever they've sent in so far has failed.
A shape-changing robot, where'd they get that idea? Michael Bay?
I was going to say James Cameron, but, you know, either way.
So the technology doesn't exist. So regardless of how dangerous or how benign the Fukushima situation is, there's nothing we can do about it just yet.
Not yet. Nope. Absolutely not. So, yes, the underlying problem of the site cannot be addressed right now. Not even is not being addressed, cannot be addressed right now. And everything else that we hear about, all of the new developments that we hear about, are really just symptoms of the underlying problem. So when we hear about the radioactive water going out in the ocean, well, of course, that's just a symptom of the fact that the cores are still exposed somewhere in these complexes, and as the groundwater goes through the site, it's being contaminated and then running out into the ocean, and they're trying to collect this water, and they're collecting it in tanks on the site, but those tanks are leaking and breaking and filling up quickly, and it's just, I mean, there's so many different aspects to this disaster that it's difficult to even know where to begin addressing it, but the point remains that the underlying cause of all of this has not and cannot be addressed.
And do you think it was actually caused, as Benjamin Fulford claimed, by an earthquake weapon?
I would like to see the evidence for that.
Wouldn't we all? Other question I wanted to ask about Fukushima, I mean, you're saying that it's not really as bad as it's being made out. How bad is it? I mean, are we having people getting sick around the Fukushima Daiichi area? Or are we having workers down there die from the exposure, something like that?
No one has officially died from radiation exposure. There have been a number of workers, several workers who have died on site from various accidents, but no one has officially died from officially concluded radiation poisoning or what have you, but there have been people who have dropped dead with heart attacks and things that have just been explained by stress or what have you, so I think we should take that with a grain of salt. There's been research on thyroid cancer. There's been an increase in the number, the detection, basically, of the number of cases of thyroid cancer in children in Fukushima area. But people are saying, well, that's because there's an unprecedented screening that's going on right now. And that screening is basically finding more examples of not necessarily thyroid cancer, but the early signs of what could be, basically lymph nodes or whatever, that could be cancerous or become cancerous. And that's being detected more because they're doing more testing for it. So there's that argument. There was that case with the U.S. naval officers who were suing the U.S. government for basically positioning their naval carrier in the area at the time of the Fukushima disaster. And people were complaining of various ailments, physical ailments. As far as I know, that case is still ongoing. I don't believe there's been any developments in it. But then there are the people on the other side who say, well, a lot of these things that they're talking about are not symptoms of radiation poisoning and are things that only developed years after the events, not at the time when you would have expected acute radiation poisoning to be setting in. There's always arguments on both sides, so I'll let people out there come to their own conclusions. They're all big boys and girls. They can decide what they believe themselves. In terms of, are there mass die-offs of people all over Japan? Well, no. And I can attest to that from my own daily life of being 400 miles, 700 kilometers southwest of the reactors. No, there are no mass die-offs or anything happening here. And in fact, one of the doctors who actually recently left Tokyo, there was a lot of stories in the alt media about this. There was a doctor who left Tokyo saying that Tokyo has been basically contaminated because of some of this runoff and fallout. But he actually left Tokyo to come to the city where I live. So if anything's a good sign, I think it would be something like that. So it's not like Japan is one big nuclear waste site, or at least not more, not significantly more so than it was before, which is to say there are all sorts of nuclear waste and radiation problems all over the world that are at this point being ignored by a lot of the people who claim to be against the nuclear energy industry, because they are concentrating on Fukushima to the exclusion of other huge problems. There was a huge leak at the Hanford nuclear site in the western United States last year that has been completely ignored by the alternative media because Fukushima. The Sellafield nuclear power plant remains an ongoing cancer on cancerous sore on the planet, even after its decommissioning, because of it, the Irish Sea is in fact the most radioactive sea in the world. But you wouldn't know that because Fukushima.
That's all why they call it. That's why they call it the Emerald Isle.
Yeah, it certainly glows in the dark more so than it used to. All of these things, as I say, are basically being ignored because people are concentrating only on Fukushima. And I think that the bigger problem of nuclear energy generally is that even if there isn't the meltdown, I mean, obviously meltdowns are not a good thing. Obviously, that's a problem. Obviously, we have to be aware of it. But I think that even without the meltdowns, there are huge problems related to the nuclear industry, and that the nuclear industry is nothing other than a fraud that's been perpetrated on the public for over, well, about 70 years now, more or less.
Could you explain?
On the basis... Sorry?
Could you explain?
Hello?
Like, how is the whole nuclear Absolutely. Industry
Well,
from?
Where did the idea for nuclear reactors and energy too cheap to meter and all of this come from? This was all developed by the U.S. Naval Research, who were basically looking for ways to power nuclear submarines and what have you. So the original reactor designs were designed in naval research laboratories and with the active support of U.S. naval researchers, and then that ultimately gets filtered down to the public and promoted through the Atoms for Peace project. And people should look into the history of that project and basically how it was CIA propaganda that was used to sell that technology around the world under the slogan "Energy too cheap to meter. It's going to be the nuclear age. Yay, we've harnessed the power of the atom, and you'll never have to pay for electricity again." And all of this garbage that was used to sell this idea and sell these reactors around the world. But the interesting thing about nuclear energy is, one, it is not economically feasible, and two, it is a wonderful way of producing material for nuclear weapons. Of course, how are you going to produce all of this plutonium for the nuclear weapons? How are you going to refine all that uranium? Nuclear reactors, like the kinds used in nuclear power plants, are a wonderful production technique to get that plutonium. So basically, all of this nuclear energy industry and the promotion of it was done by the U.S. government and intelligence agencies as part of a longer-term plan to make this an adjunct of the nuclear weapons industry. And that's what it is at base. And that's why, for example, Japan, although officially a non-nuclear country in the nuclear weapons sense, could become one at the flip of a switch, basically, because they have enough plutonium refined here through their reactors that they could actually create nuclear weapons if they wanted to. And that's the point. Any country that says they have a new peaceful nuclear energy program is lying. Nuclear energy is really just used as an excuse, as a backdoor for a nuclear weapons program. It always has been. It always is. That's the only reason the nuclear energy industry exists. And that's something that's being neglected to a large extent when people talk about nuclear energy.
Mm. Well, I guess blowing people to pieces is one way of creating peace.
Yeah. Peace, yes, indeed. The operative word. And people should ask themselves, how did a country like Japan, that the only country to suffer a nuclear bombing in wartime, embraced nuclear power so completely that it's now, well, it has been for a long time, the primary way of generating electricity here, although not for the last couple of years since they shut all the plants down? It's because there was a coordinated campaign, which includes documentable CIA liaisons working with the major newspaper publishers here in Japan to sell this idea to the public that nuclear power was going to be the way of the future. And it was eventually embraced because of a large degree of collusion between the government and the nuclear energy industry here. And that's exactly why the nuclear regulators regulators, quote unquote, who were supposed to be looking over and looking at issues like what was occurring and what was coming up in Fukushima. That shouldn't have ever happened. And why did it happen? It's because the nuclear energy industry and the nuclear regulators are one and the same here in Japan, exactly as they are in the United States, exactly as they are in every country around the world, because it's a giant con game that's being played.
Yeah, it's
and
the
that's
fox,
the real secret of nuclear power.
It's the fox building their hen house, and I'm sure this all happened at a time when the U.S. influence on Japan after the war was just at its peak. We'll be right back after the break with my special guest, James Corbett from thecorbettreport.com. And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. It's true, I am no Superman, but laser beams do shoot out of my eyes if I see David Rockefeller. My very special guest is James Corbett from the Corbett Report, been running for quite some time now, and is, in terms of the, you know, broader alternative media, one of the best voices, you know, that kind of thing. And you must really appreciate people who do their due diligence, do the work, and accept the facts, rather than trying to manipulate them in order to click whore, which is quite the frustrating thing about some sections of the alternative media. James, welcome back.
Glad to be back.
Yes. Now we were talking.
I don't know how to respond to that.
it matters not. We were talking over the break about accusations and things like that. Now, when you're getting attacked for telling the truth, it's not going to stop you telling the truth. No more than when you're walking home and it starts raining, do you stop walking home. You know? And people have got to realize this, especially newcomers into the alternative media field. If you're not shilling BS for a living, you will be accused of being a shill, ironically enough. And with those people, first you laugh at them, then you ridicule them, and then you block them, and you never hear from them again. But unfortunately, there's so many of them out there that you can't possibly block them all, and it's kind of part of the gig, isn't it?
It certainly is. If you're not being accused of being some sort of shill for some sort of agenda, then you either haven't been on the internet long enough, or you're doing something wrong, because basically everyone gets accused of that at some point. If you have a ridiculously thin skin and can't basically treat those types of accusations for what they're worth, then you probably shouldn't be involved in this, because ultimately that's going to happen at some point, whether you're putting out YouTube videos or whatever, or whether you're just participating in a forum conversation. And it is an unfortunate tendency of the alt media, isn't it, that those types of accusations are just so quick to come, that anyone who doesn't precisely and in every aspect agree completely with what you think is automatically a government shill. And it's unfortunate. I understand why that happens, because there are documented and verifiable government programs to plant fake people on the internet, that we know that Israel and others have been doing that. That's the openly documented programs. We know about COINTELPRO and the FBI and how they've for decades inserted people into various groups, but they don't do that anymore, right? Wink, wink. So we know that exists. We know about cognitive infiltration and all this, but unfortunately it just leads to the atmosphere that if someone doesn't agree with everything that you say, think, and believe, they must be a shill. And that's unfortunate, but again, it is what it is. And if you're bothered by that, then yeah, you probably shouldn't be looking into the truth, because you're going to get a lot of that kind of kickback.
It's unavoidable. It's inevitable, more or less. And I found another element is that newcomers try to become famous and big very quickly by exposing somebody who's already big, who's already there, and just go, oh, this person's really bad, etc. And you know that you've become successful when people gain an audience off of attacking you.
Yeah, and yeah, again, I understand how that works, and it's quite a natural phenomenon that people who become big and famous are going to get attacked more, and so again, I understand how all this works, why it's so tempting for people who are up and coming to do that as well, because as you say, it does get sort of instant audience for people to, oh, I'm exposing this person, so you better watch me, and it works, and that's why people do it, but I think ultimately, that type of thing, ultimately an audience will see through, whether if you actually have something valuable to contribute or not. And it might take a month, it might take a year, it might take a few years, but eventually an audience will see through if you have nothing in your bag of tricks other than everyone else is wrong, just trust me.
It's just the arrogance and the stupidity of it, eh? And it's not just on the part of those people who actually build careers out of that sort of thing, but also the audiences sometimes are... Let's just face facts here. There's a lot of crazy people on the internet. It's pretty well documented that society is getting crazier by the day. And if you are trying to speak in a sane manner, you make yourself a target. But anyway, moving on from this, you seem to be able to deal with it very well, James, like water off a duck's back. Have you ever had one of those days where you're like, you know what, I'm just going to take the day off. I just can't be bothered with this stuff.
You get days like that. I mean, obviously, when it just seems, well, what's the point of this? But obviously, it hasn't had that ultimate effect on me in the end yet, and I don't imagine it will by this point. I think I've heard every accusation there is and had every type of feedback and kickback. One that's particularly interesting to me now is that I've basically dedicated my work this year towards looking at solutions and looking at things we can actually do and affect and change in our lives and how we can actually make this world a better place. I've been really trying to dedicate more and more of my work to that this year, and now I'm starting to get kickback against that. You know, oh, well, you're trying to look at solutions. Well, oh, that must mean you're starting to get a big head and you're trying to tell us what to do and things like this. And I was like, okay, well, anything that I try to do, people are going to kick back against. But again, it really doesn't fundamentally bother me because I'm not in this for any sort of outside verification or approval. I think that's the thing. I mean, I got into this when 9/11, saying 9/11 was an inside job was still something a bit transgressive about that. That was not a popular thing back when I started saying this. And I always expected a lot of kickback against my work. And interestingly, I mean, once you start to build up an audience, that audience, of course, is with you because they agree with your core beliefs, like 9/11 truth or what have you. And it's actually been for a long time I've had a lot of audience that really agrees with a lot of what I'm saying, which is almost, in a way, it's uncomfortable because I got into this to be transgressive and to say things that people didn't want to hear, and here I am with maybe preaching too much to the choir. But don't worry, I guarantee anyone who comes across me and thinks, oh, you know, I like what he's saying, there will be a point at which I say something you disagree with. Don't worry. It will come. It's just a question of how we handle that and whether we can have mature adult conversations on the internet with people we disagree or not. So, you know, and I'm confident that can happen. And yeah, there are crazy people, there are unreasonable people, there are people who you can't reason with, and they will unfortunately usually be the vocal minority. But I think there is a majority of people out there who are sane, who are rational, who can understand these things. And I do have faith that the audience sees through baloney eventually. And on the whole, obviously, there are people who slip through the cracks, but, you know, what are you going to do?
What I like about you is you don't tend to get too overly emotional on it. You kind of always remain very composed when you're doing your shows and your broadcasts. You don't, you know, like me, sometimes I'll like yell or scream, or, you know, occasionally it'll get ahead of me and I might actually accidentally swear or something. And I think that's because I just haven't kind of matured enough to a degree.
I don't know what to say about that other than that's just my temperament, and I can't be anything other than what I am. I'm not a kind of person who's going to get overly emotional anyway, so it's just the way I am, and this is just the way I respond to it. And that appeals to some people, it doesn't to others. I know some people like the emotional response, and why not? I mean, we should be passionate about what's going on, and if you're the type of person who gets passionate and carried away, then I think there will be people out there who will respond to that. And my underlying point in all of this has always been, I don't really, like, I have a way of delivering this information that some people will like and others won't, and I don't really care if people do or don't. I really just care that they get the information itself. So if you get it from me or you get it from someone else, just find the information. And if you need to find someone who delivers it in the right way for you, that's fine and understandable, and I think we all have to do that to some extent.
What did you do before all of this started happening for you? I mean, were you like doing a normal job, 9 to 5, like everybody else, or what happened?
Sure was, yeah. I was a teacher here in Japan. For a few years, I was teaching in a private company here. It was the largest private teaching company in Japan. So teaching everyone from junior high kids all the way up to elderly retired people, basically conversational English. And then I switched into the public school system, elementary and junior high, and did that for a few years. And then for the last few years, I have been able to do this full time thanks to the support of my listeners and subscribers and people who donate and DVD sales and all of that, which is, it's just phenomenal to me. It's amazing. Every day I have to pinch myself to remind myself that I am really here doing this for a living, which is incredible, and something that I don't take for granted, because I realize that any other time in human history, there's no way I could have been doing what I'm doing right now, speaking to however many tens of thousands of people on a weekly basis, and with all of the support from people all around the world. It is truly amazing what is possible right now in this window of opportunity, and I don't know how long it'll be possible, but I'm trying to make the most of it while it is.
What was your motivation to begin? What happened?
I guess you could say anger, in a way. Basically anger that a lot of this information that I was suddenly coming across in 2006 when I started looking into some of this stuff, I just wasn't seeing it reflected anywhere in the mainstream media, in the education system. And in my entire life, I'd never heard any of this type of talk about, you know, what is the Federal Reserve? Where is money created? How does this all happen? What, you know, false flag terrorism, all these things I'd never heard about, and I wasn't seeing them discussed at all, let alone discussed seriously in the mainstream. And that was just bewildering to me and enraging. And I thought, well, you know, here we are, it's the internet age. Why not actually put some of this stuff out there? And I had no idea that it would become what it's become and the Corbett Report would be what it is. But here I am, and I'm so glad that I did seize that moment of opportunity, because I can't even imagine what it would be like if I was still thinking of myself as a spectator to all of this, just passively waiting for some mainstream establishment mouthpiece puppet broadcaster to suddenly start talking about all this. I mean, that would just be so depressing. I couldn't even imagine that. And that's why I think I'm such a proselytizer for what's possible if more people started getting involved in this. Because I've seen it from my perspective, going from a spectator being angry and, you know, screaming at the idiot box to being a participant in a worldwide conversation and helping to shape that conversation. That's a pretty transformative thing. And it shows from my own side that it is possible to actually start shaping the world rather than simply watching it unfold. And once you get into that mentality, it's addictive. And how could you ever go back to just simply watching as things unfold rather than realizing you are an active participant in the creation of history?
One time, my money ran out, and my wife told me, Vinny, you have to go get a job. So I go, all right. And I go down to my best mate, Jono, and he gives me a job selling insulation for houses, you know, door-to-door knocking. And the night before, I was sitting in bed thinking about the morning, getting up, going to work, putting on a suit, and then going and selling products that I don't really agree with, you know. In some cases, they were, like, toxic. And I actually had a panic attack. Like it was really quite traumatic for me. And so I called my mate in the middle of the night and just said, bro, I can't turn out to work. I have to find some other way. And then I begged my listeners, like literally begged them, to bail me out. And they did. And I think it was at that moment that I realized that I'm totally employer phobic. A fear of gainful employment. And that because I do so much for so many people, I mean, just the guests alone, the amount of guests that I have on the show that I give coverage to and are very friendly with in general, just that alone garners me a lot of street cred and a lot of support. And I realized that this isn't something that I'm going to be doing temporarily. This is something that I am now obligated to do permanently, because I have the resources and the experience to do it when nobody else in New Zealand does.
And think about that for a second. I mean, you didn't want to go and dress up and be a shill for some company that, for some product that you don't care about. And I look at it that way when it comes to the media that I'm producing. People, basically, since I started the website, they're always saying, oh, so you're going to put advertising up, right? You're going to do an advertising model. And I've never wanted to do that, and I've always said no. And I've never had advertising on the website, and I never will. and people kind of find that amazing. To me, it's just logical. Why would I spend all this time putting my blood, sweat, and tears into creating and crafting all this media, only to just hand it over to some company to shill their product to my listeners? That's ridiculous. We live in an age where I'm talking directly to people who are listening directly to me. There's no corporate middleman or what have you in between us. They can support me if they like the work. And that's the model going forward. That's the peer-to-peer economy, which is developing, which is truly, I think, going to transform the nature of the economy that we're living through. You don't have to sell out to some third-party corporation. You can do it directly, and you can be supported directly by the people who appreciate your work. That is transformative. That is wonderful. That's something we have to embrace and I think push through to its logical conclusion.
This is the new business model and it is working. Many people have proved that it works, and yet others do not accept that fact, do not accept that reality, and continue, however, to make all those calls, get all those advertisers, sign all those contracts, and basically spend a good portion of the minutes out of every single one of your broadcasts. And I've listened to some radio shows where the segment doesn't even last 5 minutes, James. You know, it's unbelievable. We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen. And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the final segment of the Vinnie Eastwood Show with my very special guest, James Corbett. Now, I've been trying to think, you know, what are my guests passionate about? And I found the easiest way to figure that out is to frickin' ask them. And what we were talking about over the break was this peer-to-peer economy. We mentioned it in the previous segment, but it's worthy of expansion because ultimately it's not controlled by the criminal bankers to a large degree. And that's nice. That's a solution-oriented thing, isn't it? Imagine if you could change the direction of the entire economy.
Yeah, imagine. And you can. We don't have to imagine. It's happening. Whether you're a part of it or not, it's happening. And that's the exciting thing to me. I mean, could it? That's the thing. You say it's not controlled by the banksters or what have you. Well, it could be, and some aspects of it already are being co-opted in that way. But the point is that the beauty of the peer-to-peer economy is that it is what we make it. It is us. It is us directly participating and connecting with each other. So for people who don't know, peer-to-peer economy, this is not a new term. I didn't coin it. It's been around for a while, but I suppose independently coined it. I did a podcast episode recently that was based on an article I wrote a few months ago about the peer-to-peer economy, and I was just looking for a way of kind of encapsulating a number of different things that are going on in the economy right now because of various technological developments and also some transformations in consciousness in some ways about what the economy is and how it functions. And so I hit upon peer-to-peer, which of course takes its analogy from computer networking, where a peer-to-peer network is a network where there is no central server through which all the information has to be passed. A peer-to-peer network, basically all the points on the node can connect to each other directly and share information directly with each other rather than going through a central server. So in my podcast episode that I recently had up about this, I put the analogy out there that it's like if you look at the Industrial Revolution and the way that changed society, what it fundamentally did was create these sort of central servers in the economy, which were the factories where all of the materials had to be flown in from wherever, you know, points thousands of miles away in some cases, and congregated in this one spot. And then, of course, all the workers would have to go to this central server factory to congregate to do the work. And then the products would be shipped out all over the world to the various nodes of the network. And that was the type of network economy that existed in the industrial era. We don't need to do that anymore. And that idea, that model is already being dismantled through a lot of different developments. But you can look at things like additive manufacturing, aka 3D printing, and things like that that are completely transforming the idea of what it means to even create products. I mean, real, physical, actual products, let alone things like what we're doing, the information that's being passed around in the economy right now. And because of this, and because of things like a million different websites and platforms you could think of right now, they're completely transforming the ways that we relate to each other. Rather than basically being cogs in a machine, working at factories, doing some soul-depriving assembly line type of job, or working in a corporate office, working at some cubicle, life-depriving type of job, we are now at the point where we can literally interact with people directly, one-on-one, and through that we can think of all sorts of different ways to not only just do business. I mean, of course you can do business in that way in a conventional sense, and you could think of something like an eBay or whatever, which is really just a conventional way of having a flea market, I guess, but throughout the entire world, so you have a pretty large customer base. And unfortunately, eBay is basically, if you look into the founders and the corporate backing and all of that, I mean, it's a horrible company, and I don't really like it. But anyway, it's a good idea. And but of course, there's those types of businesses. But there's also different ways of conceptualizing how to even consume or use or create products in this economy. So we have the idea of collaborative consumption. Basically, does everyone on your block need to own a stepladder or some of these other tools and instruments that you may use once or twice a year? Well, of course not. But how do you go about coordinating the sharing of such items through a community? Well, now that's easier than ever. You can have, and there are websites like NeighborGoods, I think it's neighborgoods.com, where you can coordinate sharing all sorts of kitchen appliances and tools and household goods among communities, and you can just share them with your neighbors rather than everyone owning one. That is a fundamental transformation in the economy that is taking place right now. And of course, people know about the ride-sharing apps and those types of things that are coming up now that are completely undermining taxi companies and hotel chains and all of these other businesses that have been entrenched in the public consciousness for so long, because how else can you do it? Well, you can do it directly between people. Hey, I've got space in my car, you're going to the place I'm going to, let's share. So that's transforming it. And there's also, I mean, incredible things that are happening in terms of collaborative communities for production, peer production that's taking place, where you have projects like Local Motors or OS Vehicle, where you have designers from all over the world contributing to open source projects to create blueprints, downloadable open source blueprints for roadworthy vehicles. You can literally download a car, or at least the blueprints for one, now, because of these open source communities that are coming together to design all sorts of things. So I can't stress just how transformative all of these things are. And of course, there's going to be kickback and regulations and what have you. But I really don't think that the genie can be fully stuffed back into this bottle. And we've reached a point where the limit is on our own imaginations and what we are willing or able to do with it. Everyone who is listening to this right now has something that they do, something that they want to do, something that they think is their real talent. Hopefully there are people out there who are doing it right now. But for those who aren't, whether it's, I don't know, writing a poem or playing a song or creating a little knickknack or gugad, it's never been easier to share that with people all around the world, or to sell it in a business type concern or what have you. That is the peer-to-peer economy. And it's not just economic, it's not just technological, it's a question of how society itself is ordered, how we relate to each other, the types of interactions we have as human beings, which is really what the basis of what economy really is.
And I think that what's happened in terms of the current economy is it's been taken out of people's hands. Like, I remember I was having a discussion with a financial researcher, and he was noting that Duncan Garner, who's our political editor and our economic reporter here in New Zealand, he went over to the United States accompanying the Prime Minister, John Key, who's a former Federal Reserve derivatives trader, and was sitting in a conversation with John Key and Tim Geithner, the Secretary of the Treasury or whatever he was. And Duncan Garner says, well, when those guys get talking about that, then it's just a whole different form of language. And it's like, he doesn't even understand it. He's supposed to be the reporter for everybody to understand the economy, and he doesn't even understand the stuff that he's reporting on, right? And I think it's like, whoa. People have created a whole bunch of BS wankery in order to conceal their crimes. And that's pretty much the economy in a nutshell. It's a really complicated crime.
That's it. Matt, you're exactly right. It is. It is a crime that's been perpetrated and refined for centuries. And of course, they've got their own lingo to basically pull the wool over everyone's eyes. But it does basically boil down to that. It was a crime that's been instituted in the era of central banking, where the central bankers and their cronies can literally dictate the entire economy by simply manipulating the money supply, which is the most insidious way to do it, because hardly one person in 10,000 could even fathom that, let alone understand how it really works. So it's a really effective system, and it is starting to be exposed, and some of the information is starting to be shared around, but still a lot of people are in the dark about that. And people ask, when they start to find out about this, well, they think, well, what can you do? I mean, you need a bank account. You need to work in this economy. You need these types of fiat pieces of paper that they tell you is money. Well, no, you don't. You really don't. And you less and less so as time goes on. I mean, not only are there whatever precious metals or cryptocurrencies or all the other things that you can do to get around the fiat money system, but there's also now there's lending club and things like this, peer-to-peer lending that's going on where you don't need to go to a bank to try to get money for a mortgage or what have you. You can literally source it from people in your community or people that you know or people that you trust or people that or complete strangers, depending on what kind of risks and what kind of things you're willing to get involved with. But it does exist now. I mean, we really literally don't need these banker middlemen for anything at this point. It's just a question of how far we're willing to push this.
Yeah, we should just go directly to the source. And isn't it part of the internet economy now, open source? Open source software, open source this, that, and the other. And these people who've created these programs, like one that I like in particular, and it's great for Mac users, is called SMC Fan Control. It installs into your computer, and then there's a little tab up the top near your clock where you can click it open, and you can actually turn the fans of your computer up. So when you're working really, really hard, like through the night or something, and your computer's starting to overheat, you can just crank the fans up full, and the computer goes like the whole time, man. It's so awesome for working.
And, can you make that sound again? That's a great fan sound.
Good job. Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, it's almost as good as a stadium full of fans.
Remarkably similar.
Yes, yes. Now, I think we're coming straight to the end of the segment now, James. So I want to thank you very much for tuning up and, of course, give you a little bit of promo here. Go to his website, ladies and gentlemen, thecorbettreport.com, or just search Corbett Report and get yourself some information today. And it's fun, and if you like it, you can support them. And also for those of you who like to support me, and the whole reason of this show isn't really, you know, credible journalism, it's incredible journalism. I'm here to make it fun because, you know, let's face it, the truth can be really quite stressful and depressing sometimes. And unless you're able to make really terrible jokes about it, it will make you feel really terrible. You know what I'm saying? So thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen, for supporting me. Thank you very much for all of those who support James as well. And we shall see you again sometime, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much.